Welcome to the Magnificast, a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. I'm your co-host from this side of the pond, Dean Detloff.
And I'm your co-host on the other side of the pond, Matt Bernico.
It's a big pond. I think it's actually too big. There are so many time zones between this pond and that pond.
Yeah, it's like a big lake, if you think about it.
Well, I am thinking about it, and I don't think it is like a big lake. I'm sorry. I know we're supposed to yes and on this show, but I'm thinking it's more of an ocean.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I guess so. You could call it that. What is an ocean but not just many lakes all together is what I'm saying.
True. When you put it that way, I guess I can't but yield to your flawless logic.
Thank you. I appreciate you yielding. Both of us living in these great parliamentary democracies, and it's really rubbing off on us in a weird way.
It's true.
I don't like it either, but I would like to yield the rest of my time back to you right now.
Okay, great. That's good, because I am here to introduce this episode, what we're going to talk about for the next hour. Maybe, I don't know, we're already kind of off the rails. It's a bit of a silly mood, I guess, on the weekend here. All right, last time on the Magnificast, here's the recap. You could put some really intense music underneath this. I've been watching a lot of Lost, so maybe that's why I'm starting it that way. Last time on the Magnificast, we did talk about Jesus and his political economy, and guess what? He has one, and Richard Horsley is here to tell you about it in this great book that he wrote called You Shall Not Bow Down and Serve Them, The Political Economic Projects of Jesus and Paul. It is a really interesting book. If you haven't listened to the episode last time, maybe you'll want to, because we're going to talk about the second half of the book today, which is about Paul. So we focused on Jesus last time. This time we'll focus on Paul. People tend to think that Paul and Jesus are extremely different, and maybe they are. I couldn't tell you. Maybe they are. But with regard to economics, the kind of story that Horsley tells is that Paul's doing this really interesting kind of like role of being a community organizer in line with what we know about the Gospels and economics. So Jesus kind of opens this pathway to think differently, to do different stuff, to be together in a different way, and to embody a kind of anti-imperial logic in the community of his followers. And Paul comes along and says, whoa, that's great and very cool, and I'm here to make sure that it happens after Jesus' death. So Jesus plants the seed.
That's great. Paul. That's pretty cool. That's my favorite part from Paul's letter to the Corinthians. I love when he says that. It really speaks to me.
Yeah, me too. It's one of my favorite. It's my life verse, actually. So Paul, in this episode, we're going to talk about the similarities, dissimilarities between Jesus and Paul as Horsley sees them. But I think the real key here is to see Paul as an economic agent or a political economic agent, a person who cares about politics and the economy and sees those things as bound up in all the other things he thinks about Jesus. Does that seem fair, Matt? Is that what we agreed to talk about before the show?
It is what we agreed to talk about. But before we do, let's cap off the previously on portion of this podcast. And let me just ask you, Dean, to maybe do the recap here for a bit. Where did we kind of end up with Jesus and his economic situation? Everyone thinks Jesus is this weird spiritual leader, but in fact, he has something to say about economics. What is it that he has to say about economics?
Right. Wow. Really testing me on whether or not I can remember what I read and talked about a week ago, but I'll try. Jesus, he is an interesting economic thinker because he places a huge kind of value or valorization on the community, especially of peasants in Rome and the kind of poor and dispossessed community. And Horsley draws out a lot about how Jesus is basically constantly trying to both kind of provide an economic analysis for the people who are following him in some interesting ways, but also to really like boost up the community sense of belonging that people have. There is a lot of subsistence farming going on in his particular region in Judea and in Rome in general. And Jesus thinks that that is a very precarious kind of way to live. And he wants to figure out how to strengthen the bonds between people, the kind of bonds of solidarity that they need, both to survive that kind of economic situation, which is pretty violent, but also to try to do something different. So whether it's performing a miracle or doing a parable or giving a sermon or a speech, Jesus is constantly trying to get people to kind of understand how they're disempowered and also lean into those bonds that should make them more empowered to do something counter to what Rome is trying to do by exploiting them, siphoning off all their value, etc. Does that seem right? Am I leaving anything out?
No, I think that sounds really great. Yeah, that is that's the Jesus I heard about last week. Some different good news than your soul is saved or whatever. Maybe you're getting a bad deal. Roman imperialism is bad. Some great takeaways.
That's right. So we'll get to Paul in a second. But one thing we thought we might kind of do to situate this conversation is to talk about that big German word that everybody loves, hermeneutics. It is, I guess hermeneutics isn't a German word exactly, but all the Germans are talking about it. It is something we wanted to talk about because in our Discord, there have been a lot of folks having really interesting conversations about how to read the Bible and what it means to approach it in a historical way, but also in lots of other ways. What are the kind of limits and opportunities of things like historical criticism, which is what Horsley is doing in a certain sense. And we thought it might be good just to start with a little conversation about that before we get into Paul. So, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you. What should we say at the top of this about how we approach the Bible?
Yeah, well, I think that we can make a quick distinction between what Horsley is doing and what we are doing, because maybe that's an unhelpful thing. You know, like we're trying to read this Horsley book and trying to learn something about economics in the Bible, because that's like, you know, the particular locus of our podcast, and good for us for doing that, I think, and finding a book that's like really fitting this niche. That's great. And historical criticism is doing that, right? It's using sociology, it's using all kinds of like sort of historical subdisciplines and all types of different like critical aspects of history to understand the context that the Gospels is happening within, and also, you know, not just the Gospels, but also all of the New Testament, all the stuff that's happening in the other half of the Bible, not the Old Testament, the New Testament. It's using history and all these kind of critical methods to kind of figure out what's going on behind the scenes. What are the big political, economic sort of concerns of the day, and like how does what Jesus is saying or what Paul is saying play into those things, right? I think that they're, and that's cool. That's a great thing to do. And that's what Horsley's after. And I think that Horsley is doing it in a way that's like legitimate and rigorous. And I think he's doing his best is what I'm trying to say. But also, I think there's another aspect to it that we maybe were bringing to the podcast, where historical criticism is really good and it can tell us some things and it can activate our religious understandings of the Bible, and it can give us sort of new, like we said last week, ammunition to be annoying in the Bible study. And that's all really good, right? It gives us all kinds of new meaning. But I think that the part that we always like to add in these conversations about hermeneutics is that it does not, like, that's not the limit of meaning, or historical criticism is not exhaustive of what the Bible says or doesn't say. And I think that is another good piece to kind of get on the table. Historical criticism is good. It gives us a whole new set of things to kind of think about and play with. But it does not have, like, the last word on, like, maybe like what a text actually means. And that is not like a that's not because of the particular like religious nature of the Bible or like some kind of spiritual aspect of it or something that like you just can't have the last word in the Bible. But that's just like, I think texts in general, and especially ancient texts, you just like whenever you're reading them, you're kind of looking through a scanner darkly, right? You're not like ever kind of you don't have full access to the intent and meaning and like the extent of meaning. So whenever you kind of come to it, you're always going to be finding something new that maybe you didn't know was there or wasn't there before, right? So yeah, does that make sense, Dean? Am I saying the right things?
I think so. I think you are. And just to point out maybe with some examples of other ways of encountering it, we had basically the same exact conversation when we were doing the episodes on the Gospel in Salentiname from a long time ago. And I think that is still my like go-to example whenever I think about kind of other ways of reading the Bible that are sort of still true, but maybe not historically true, like true in a different kind of way. So briefly, I'll just explain what it is. The Gospel in Salentiname, it's this record of Nicaraguan peasants talking about the Bible and kind of reading themselves into the Gospels and vice versa, reading the Gospel stories into Nicaragua under dictatorship in some really intentional ways. And there is some historical stuff going on there. They draw a little bit from some historical research and so on through Ernesto Cardenal, the priest who is accompanying them. But by and large, they're just kind of like getting wild with it. Like they're reading Mary as this revolutionary woman. They're reading Jesus as basically like, I don't know, a like militant socialist organizer, all this kind of stuff that is like not historically accurate per se, but not for that reason untrue. It kind of activates the community in this different way. And the question is, you know, is there some truth in drawing the analogy, even if it's not a historical truth? And the what they're trying to do in a text like that or in a conversation like that is not to pin down the ultimate truth of the gospel or the ultimate historical or scientific truth of it, but instead to be like, this is what makes the gospel true for us in Nicaragua in the 1980s right now. And I think actually one thing I like a lot about Horsley is that historical criticism tends to go toward the sort of like, I'm telling you the ultimate truth of the gospel that you didn't know, the kind of secret knowledge that you had no idea about. And when you've read my great scientific analysis, you'll know for sure what the Bible said. I think Horsley, I mean, he can maybe like tend toward that sort of tendency a little bit. It kind of comes with the territory, but he's also very open to many other ways of reading the Bible. And something I've appreciated about this book, which we'll talk about at the very end when he draws his own analogy between the Bible and our time, is that he's kind of like, you know, you can create resonances and analogies between the Bible and our time, but the key is really to just figure out, like, how does the Bible maybe open up new possibilities for us to think today? And historical criticism can get you into a space where you actually see possibilities that you wouldn't have seen before, because when you read the Bible living in a capitalist society, you can kind of miss the more interesting stuff happening there that is out of step with capitalism. So for Horsley, putting the historical critical stuff to work is a means of not fixing like the ultimate truth of the Bible, but instead expanding our horizons of possibilities for kind of like what to do with it. So, I mean, that's why at least I find stuff like that really interesting. I think there's a weird like liberal version of conservative ways of approaching the Bible where like the key is to figure out exactly what the Bible said and then sort of proceed as though like that's really all you need to do. And once you know that, you just kind of do that. So whether Jesus ends up being like, I don't know, a fundamentalist Baptist or something, or whether he ends up being like liberal Presbyterian, I think both of those sort of conclusions are basically conservative impulses. So someone like Horsley, I think, is trying to do something a little more creative.
Yeah, it's true. He says as much a few times throughout the book, even saying that like, this is what biblical scholars actually have to offer people, not the absolute historical truth necessarily, even though, well, I'll say about that in a minute. Not the necessarily historical truth, but that there's something that you can do with this, right? That this has like an active, this can have an active sort of play in the lives of Christian people or church people in general. The other thing I want to say too, though, is Richard Horsley is doing historical criticism. And also, maybe I wouldn't want Richard Horsley to have the same opinion about the Bible that I do right now, because I feel like he wouldn't be as good of a historical criticism guy if he did. So maybe right. It's a necessary contradiction. Like, if you're going to do historical criticism, I want you to really believe that it's like important to do exactly right.
Yeah, exactly.
So attention to live within. I feel like that's all good. Do you want to talk about Paul?
Obviously, yeah. I super want to talk about Paul. Let's start with maybe some of the stuff around the relationship between Jesus and Paul, because this is like a really fun conversation on the left. People, both, I guess, like biblical people and progressive Christians, but also people on the left more generally, have often drawn a pretty hard line between Jesus and Paul in ways that I think are like sometimes interesting and sometimes not. And basically, I don't lose sleep over whether or not Paul and Jesus were like on the same page. So it's maybe like, for me, it's like not the most exciting thing, but it has led to some really interesting conclusions. For example, like the basic story goes that Jesus had this radical message in the first century, and it was really egalitarian and interesting and, you know, opening more and more space for women and outcasts and all this kind of stuff. And then Paul came along and sort of like domesticated it or spiritualized it too much, or kind of like gave Jesus's life a meaning that it wouldn't have had otherwise, that sort of put us on a path toward, more like logic-centric modes of thinking, more theologizing. This is like the basic story that's told. Does that seem fair, Matt? Like Jesus is the Muslim guy and Paul, he's like the bad theoretician of it or something, kind of domesticating it.
Exactly. Paul's full of like bad vibes that ruin the cool stuff that Jesus said is usually the way the story goes.
Exactly. And I mean, like, maybe there's something to that. I honestly don't know. I've personally just never seen Paul that way, but also I don't, like I said, I don't think about it that much. But what Horsley does to kind of intervene in this discussion, I think is really interesting. He basically makes an argument that Paul is in a sort of like complicated continuity with Jesus. And when I say complicated, I mean, Horsley goes out of his way to say, like, Paul didn't have access to like the Bible that we have, right? He didn't have the sayings of Jesus written down. He didn't have basically a familiarity with like the living movement of Jesus, except secondhand, right? He wasn't one of the disciples. He was a kind of later apostle, right? And what that means is Paul is definitely doing something with Jesus for sure. He's expanding a lot of stuff that Jesus is doing, adding his own interpretation and gloss and so on. But Horsley seems to think that what Paul is doing is pretty productive, though, and not like out of step with what Jesus is up to. And in fact, he does a kind of expansion of what Jesus had kind of inaugurated. So, for example, he says this about the mission of Paul that I think is pretty interesting. First, far from being a new religion, the mission of Paul was indeed connected to the movement of renewal of Israel begun by Jesus through intermediate steps of expansion into communities of diaspora Judeans. Neither the letters of Paul nor the book of Acts are about the emergence of early Christianity from early Judaism. These are anachronistic, synthetic constructions that must be avoided if the narrative of Acts and the expansion of the movement of renewal of Israel are to be critically understood. Second, Judeans in the towns of Syria and Asia Minor had formed communities that the Romans had allowed to be semi-independent, semi-self-governing according to their own ancestral traditions, and these seem to have been the economic bases of the movement of renewal of Israel as it expanded to include more and more diaspora Judeans, God-fearers, proselytes, and other subject peoples who were eager to join communities of the movement. And then third, he says, throughout its expansion, the movement of renewal was opposed to and by the Roman imperial order in its local forms and officials. Yet despite periodic repressive measures by local officials, the movement continued to expand because those assemblies of diaspora Judeans in which it established footholds were some of the alternative communities in the interstices of the imperial order. So all that to say, what Horsley is saying is Paul didn't like come along to found a new religion called Christianity as opposed to Judaism. Instead, he basically is like coming along kind of late to a movement that's already been started and is already kind of growing and budding in these independent ways in a few different urban centers especially. And Paul finds himself like navigating this movement and trying to kind of feed it and like keep it going and help resolve disputes within it and deal with these kind of practical issues. And all the theology stuff that comes along it is almost like secondary to the organizing role that Paul is playing, or maybe it like, maybe instead of saying secondary to it, it's like part of the organizing role. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. The theology is like part of the organizing, right? They're not kind of two separate things. I think it's a really interesting interpretation, and it creates also a more like expansive view of early Christianity, or what we call today Christianity, than you might get from just like, you know, reading these discrete letters from Paul to like one community or another and seeing them as like theological treatises. That instead they're Paul's way of kind of contributing to what Jesus had already started and kind of finding himself in a movement that's already on the move, I guess.
Yeah, totally. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on there. I think the thing that was really revelatory for me when I was reading this, at least at first glance, was that the movement of Paul and even the movement of Jesus, they're theological and they're political all at the same time. We've talked about that kind of last week, but it's good to reaffirm it here. But also, like, in my brain as being like a Christian person, you know, and you read the New Testament and you read Acts or whatever, and you think like, okay, Jesus was here, he lived, he died, he was resurrected. And then like Acts happen and Paul happens, and like that's where Christianity is born as a religion. But what you get from Horsley is something kind of like a different sort of picture, that like Christianity is not a new religion in the sense of in the way that like Christianity exists today as a religion. It's sort of like a fabricated box that we kind of put all of these different theological and sociological ideas in. It like exists as it's like, there's no better word for it than just like theological and political movement all happening at the same time. it's so interesting because it, like, you know, it stems out of this particular call to renewal of Israel, which is, I think, also worth saying too, different than Judaism as you know it today as well. I mean, not disconnected either, I guess, is worth being honest about it. But it's interesting though that, like, all of these people end up kind of like piling into it. I mean, maybe for some theological reasons, but also because it recognizes a anti-colonial position in the midst of all of these different colonies. So something that Horsley talks about at length is all of these different kind of places throughout, I guess, Eastern Asia and, you know, Western Asia and the eastern parts of Europe, you know, like places that you hear about in Paul's letters, like Corinth and Philippi and Thessalonica, all these places that, I don't know, maybe you've looked it up. Maybe you've looked up, like, you know, where they are in that handy little map they put in the back of your Bible, but you don't really recognize, like, what's going on in those places. But each of them have colonial histories with Rome. They have colonial histories. They have diasporic communities. They have displaced people. The role that this particular, like, Jesus movement or the Pauline Jesus movement has in this place is to be anti-colonial. It's like it is like a stark contrast to the way that Rome works. Something else that Horsley points out in these chapters about Paul too is the, like, extent to which, like, civil religion in Rome was, like, kind of insane. Insane in the sense that, like, you know, you would literally worship the empire and the emperor. Like, Caesar was the guy. There'd be a big statue of him. You'd sacrifice something to him. All this kind of stuff. So to, like, you know, have this emerging call to renewal of these, you know, older Israelite sort of like these reminiscent ideas of a more idyllic past, even though if you read the Old Testament, not very idyllic, but, you know, it's this call back to, like, a clear sort of, like, direction in the world amidst an occupying army. I mean, it all kind of, like, maybe clicks into place in my brain where, like, this thing makes sense. Like, this is this thing being popular amongst a bunch of people in the ancient world who are, you know, colonized, it makes a lot more sense other than just people were won over by this great story about Jesus and this, like, whole theological framework or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all really fascinating. Another piece of the puzzle that I thought was good and maybe worth kind of putting out on the table here is a little bit, it's a Greek word that if you, I don't know, maybe are bumming around Bible studies long enough, you hear, but in the New Testament, the word for faith is pistis. This is, like, the Greek word pistis. You see that in, like, a Greek New Testament, or you'll read it in the footnotes of your Bible or whatever. That word is translated into faith. But Horsley says this, and this is, I think, illuminating of the whole thing that I'm saying here, that pistis meant loyalty, mainly to Caesar rather than religious faith, that has become reduced to mere belief in modern Western culture. That people became believers in Christ is far too weak a translation. They became rather Christ loyalists, meaning they could no longer be loyal to Caesar. The English term synagogue suggests a building where a Jewish congregation meets. The Greek term synagogue, however, referred to the local congregation or assembly of Judeans, which was often self-governing. Anyways, an important piece here, just to kind of, like, recognize that what Paul is building and is, like, kind of continuing on from Jesus is not, like, a church. It's not that. It's not even, like, to me, it's a religious movement, and I think that's fair, totally, to say it's a religious movement and that there's, like, a particular set of theological beliefs going on here as well. That makes sense. But it is, like, an anti-colonial movement, and I think that's something that Horsley gives us that is pretty unique within historical criticism.
Yeah, I agree. And the way that the kind of loyalism to Jesus sets up this alternative to the loyalism of Rome is really interesting. And as you kind of think about it through that anti-colonial lens, is not a hard sell to people who've been screwed over by the empire, right? It's like, yeah, this guy who basically destroyed your whole community and sent an army to kick you off your land and force you to live in the city, like, why are you worshiping that guy? That guy sucks. Like, we don't like that. Instead, what if you worship this guy who was, like, murdered by that guy? That's kind of the symbol, you know, that Jesus is the person killed by the emperor, and the kind of metaphysical interpretation is that, also that wasn't a final defeat, that the resurrection kind of takes on this new political importance, and the binding together of Jesus loyalists against the kind of imperial binding together of Caesar loyalists, I think, is such a kind of interesting turn. It really sets up a different way, too, of understanding the political importance of early Christianity as absorbing people who have been basically, like, left to fend for themselves after the empire has taken over their land. He quotes a bunch of, like, kind of interesting statistical reconstructions about the beginning of, about, like, the economic situation in Rome, which I can't, like, speak to the truth or veracity of them, but I guess the picture that he draws, which seems convincing enough to me, is that the vast majority of people living in Rome were living at or below subsistence levels of existence. So when you have Jesus coming around to being like, okay, let's bind all those people together in this other kind of vision of, you know, being kind to one another, forgiving even our enemies, and also refusing to give our loyalty to Caesar, that becomes a pretty attractive option. And you only sort of like, I don't know, it's like when you hear all that stuff in church about, like, yeah, the early Christians, like, they would, you know, refuse to give their worship to Caesar or whatever, that sort of often creates these really bizarre analogies between, like, not giving your allegiance to secular culture or right. to, like, I don't know, whatever the MTV is telling you to do or something, or the state, whatever it might be. But when you look at the way Horsley parses it out, it's like, well, it's actually way more significant than that. There's a much bigger confrontation between loyalties here, and the one loyalty binds you into solidarity with the poor, and the other loyalty binds you into oppression against the poor. And that's the kind of thing that you lose if you don't have that sort of broader political economic understanding.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Christianity gets it so wrong because you do get, like, you know, don't listen to MTV or, you know, there's a co-optation of Paul's language about, you know, being against the world or dead to the world, this whole thing, right? And evangelical Christianity, at least, I can't speak for other types, but, you know, reactionary Christianity is reactionary Christianity in some ways, but, you know, it comes down to being against the sort of, like, a decadent and degrading culture or something, when there's something just vastly different actually happening in the context. It's not about MTV at all. It's about, it's about colonialism. It's about the domination of people. It's about the marginalization of people, all this kind of stuff. A great reminder of how, deep down the rabbit hole we are. I think with Christianity in a bad way. Okay. So we have all this interesting stuff about Horsley that kind of contextualizes, like, what it is that Paul is doing. And, like, you know, like, he's writing these letters to these different communities out there in the world. Right. And, you know, but now you have some context about what these communities are dealing with, or, like, what it is that are binding these communities together. It's not just like, it's not like just youth group spirit and like whatever else. It's like an actual opposition to the Roman Empire in whatever place they are. So that's wild. Horsley also has some stuff, though, to talk about, you know, like the nature of these communities and, like, what kind of things might be going on in them, or, like, how they're set up. You know, it's not just that they are in opposition to empire, but they are existing in sort of a countercultural space. Because saying that you're to be a Christ loyalist, right, means that you can't do some things. Like, you can't take part in the empire in some ways. It means you're resisting it. It means that you have to, like, kind of find new ways of kind of existing together as a community that's, like, set against the dominant culture, which is going to make you, unpopular, to say the very least, and in danger, to say maybe more. But Horsley kind of goes towards the Acts of the Apostles, the Book of Acts, to kind of talk about some of, like, the nature of these communities and how they existed together. And there's a pretty cool part in here about the communism of goods in Acts. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast before, as you might imagine or have heard, but this is, like, Acts 4, where it's talking about how the Church of Acts. They all lived together. They shared their goods. They, you know, there's nobody in need is what it says in Acts. To kind of join the community, people would end up selling their goods, selling their land, and joining that way, and kind of throwing the proceeds into the pot or to give it to the poor, all this kind of stuff. But Horsley has some stuff in here that I think give a bit more depth to that communism of consumption or communism of goods that we've talked about in the past when it comes to the Church of Acts. And I'm going to read it here and we can reflect on it for a bit here. So Horsley writes, "To understand the communism of goods in distribution to the needy that's often dismissed as utopian and impractical, we need to explore both why it was necessary and the background of the practice in Israelite tradition. Who comprised the community of Jesus loyalists in Jerusalem? At the core were at least several of the 12 disciples headed by Peter. There may have also been others who had come up to Jerusalem with Jesus in his prophetic confrontation with the high priest in the temple. These people had left behind whatever economic base they had previously in Galilean villages, and their excitement from the breakthrough constituted by Jesus' confrontation with the high priestly rulers in the temple and his ensuing martyrdom, they may well have recruited others right away, either Jerusalemites or others from outside, including some Judean villages near to the city." Okay, so that's the first piece. The communism of goods stems from people like leaving behind their subsistence, their means of subsistence, their means of like gaining any kind of economic solidity in the world. So that's maybe the first part. And then a little bit later on the next page, Horsley writes, "In sharing the resources in common and aiding the needy, the members of the Jerusalem community were following and dramatically intensifying the Israelite tradition they were familiar with in their Galilean and Judean village communities, as known from the adaptations of early Israelite village customs and practices in the scribal collections of laws and customs in Exodus. The holiness codes in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, Israelite village communities and traditional ways of cooperation and mutual aid enabled component families to remain economically viable." What I like about this explanation is that it gives some more depth to what's happening in the Church of Acts, like what's going on with this like weird, the weird communism that you get from the Bible that, you know, conservatives never know what to do with. I guess the thing that I think is interesting about what Horsley tells us is that like the conservative reading of Acts is like, well, they live this way because, you know, they're expecting like the end of times coming soon, right? They're expecting Jesus to return in the next few days and like everything will be swept up. So like they were living in this sort of idyllic community. And, you know, now that's just not practical or whatever. And I mean, a communism of consumption, probably not practical because somebody has to do work at the end of the day. But I think what is interesting here is that there's like, first of all, a practical reason that they're living like this. A practical reason born from tradition. So I guess why I find that helpful is because it's not just that they're like living in an idyllic end times moment where they all kind of are, I don't know, like bracketing the hard work of life or like the tensions that come with sharing things communally, but they're drawing on like a sort of older tradition. I guess what I'm trying to say is this is not utopian. This is like the practice of like a type of, a way of life, a particular way of life in the world. So I guess it's helpful in combating some of those right-wing ways of thinking that write this type of bit off in the church because it's just like apocalyptic or right. Something.
And I think that's also what Horsley is maybe challenging too is to say what makes Christianity attractive to so many people in the beginning. The conservative Christian way of thinking about it, I guess, is to say people are just like blown away by hearing the truth of the gospel that, you know, Jesus is God and he died on the cross for your sins and like good for you. You know, it's kind of like the mass altar call or whatever of the first century. And I think what Horsley is saying is like that is absurd to think that like that's the primary means by which people are hearing about this and kind of getting interested in it and so on. I mean, it's like the first it's an early sort of like Food Not Bombs chapter, right? Like there's something really weird going on, people are feeding people, and there's also this kind of anti-imperial kind of streak to it that is really sort of like nuanced and interesting and kind of founded on a person who was killed for being a criminal or an enemy of the state. And that's like the piece that gets people invested. Horsley also talks about how this is part of the reason that Christianity spreads throughout Rome as well. So not only does it characterize the sort of primitive communist piece of Acts, that community, but it's really a sort of means of getting together that becomes attractive first, especially in kind of Judean diaspora communities where the language connects, and there's this kind of, you know, like it's premised on the ministry of Jesus using all this kind of familiar language and prophecy and so on. But it also attracts people outside the Judean community, that there's something really compelling just about that mode of living and kind of being together. And the further out Paul and others, Barnabas and so on, get from the kind of center nucleus of Jerusalem, the more it seems to be that sort of like being together an anti-imperial message that kind of actually feels pretty natural, you know, in colonized places to be an attractive option. And I think that is a really compelling piece. And the idea is that Paul is like self-conscious about this and not like downplaying that or hiding it, but he understands that that is really the key, that Jesus inaugurated a movement and it's Paul's job to like make sure that it continues to survive and thrive. And that's the contribution that he's making ideologically and otherwise. There's another really interesting kind of emphasis that Horsley gives too, where he talks about the different places where people already were kind of gathering and talking and almost having like, I guess what today we might call like a commons space or like a public space. The translation of synagogue, for example, Horsley argues, we just assume that like the word synagogue or synagogy or whatever in Greek is basically analogous either to like going to church or going to a contemporary synagogue today. But he says it's way more just like a place where people are hanging out and like talking about, you know, religion for sure, or kind of their religious tradition, but lots of other things too. It's a kind of public gathering space to sort out issues in the community. It's more of a local assembly. And Horsley points out there are many other words for assembly, ecclesia being one of them, and several others that kind of get, you know, mixed in here. And the emphasis is that the emphasis that Horsley gives is that basically the New Testament is really interested in the ways people get together and like what gets them together and how do they kind of find ways to communicate and organize. And I think that is like something I've also heard in maybe like post-liberal kinds of theologies, but put through Horsley's anti-imperial register makes maybe a lot more sense, or just seems more intuitively appealing than kind of the withdrawal stories that you get from other post-liberal theologians.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Let me read this one last piece from Horsley in this section, and then we can move on to talking about, you know, what this might mean for us politically, or how we would kind of, what might this activate for us politically. Towards the end of Horsley's chapters on Paul, he has this kind of like point to sort of drive it all home. Horsley writes, "To appreciate how Paul's gospel of Christ's crucifixion, resurrection, and parousia may have resonated with and motivated subject peoples in cities such as Philippi, Thessalonica, and Corinth to join and continue the fledgling counter-imperial communities, it may help to review how the gospel addressed their life circumstances. These people who had been subjugated by Caesar were variously slaves or freed slaves and displaced people living around the subsistence level in an environment that was pervaded by the presence of the imperial Lord and Savior." That is Caesar, not Jesus, right? The imperial Lord and Savior. "These peoples were regularly reminded of their subjugation by the imperial ideology and rituals and images of power that established distinctions between citizen and non-citizen, conquerors and conquered, free and slave. The counter-imperial gospel Paul preached focused on the crucifixion of Jesus by the rulers of this age. The assemblies lived their personal and community lives under the symbol of the crucifixion, and that crucified figure of abject humiliation had become their Lord and was imminently to come as direct rule of God would finally be realized." I think that's worth reading because it really communicates exactly the vibe of these communities that exist. I think it's kind of weird, maybe, how often I've heard sermons preached on the New Testament, on Paul's letters, and I've never really thought about it that much. Like, I've never really thought about the political economy that much, when it changes everything to reconsider this, right? To reconsider the ways that the people that Paul is writing to in these different places are literally at odds with the empire and are like taking up a person as their symbol and like a means of execution as like the banner that they're sitting under is completely a movement against the empire. And weird how we just never really recognize it in Christianity. We always overly spiritualize it. We individualize it. We find all other kinds of ways to read around this being the case. And we also like purposefully don't learn these particular histories, so we don't have to deal with these things either. A lot of feelings about this, but I think it's wild.
Yeah, I mean, even the phrase that Horsley uses in the title to the section that Matt was just reading from, he talks about Paul's agenda for the assemblies of interpeople alternative society, which is the kind of heading that only a biblical scholar, I guess, could write. But I think that phrasing is really interesting, that it's an interpeople society. There's a really cool emphasis. We'll talk more about this later at the very end, but there's a cool emphasis in Horsley's text here on like the kind of people formations that happen in the ancient world and what happens to those via colonial subjugation. So for example, like Matt was saying, you know, all these places that Paul is writing to, Philippi, Thessalonica, Corinth, and so on, they have these kind of imperial histories where there are peoples, you know, living there, wandering around, and so on, who get, displaced by the Roman Empire, subjugated, sold into slavery, etc. And there's something about the early movement that Paul is contributing to that's trying to draw all those peoples together. And I think that is actually really fascinating because you do get a lot of interesting left-wing readings of the Bible that focus on the class character of the early Christian movement, that this is sort of a either sub-proletarian or proto-proletarian movement of people getting together. A lot of Marxists read it that way. And I think that is like good and true and interesting. But the kind of specific attention to colonization in light of that and the way that the peoples are coming together is also really, really interesting and pretty informative, I think, for struggles today as well, that there's more identities kind of going on and more histories baked into all these political issues.
Yeah, totally. Horsley says that Corinth, I think he mentions this maybe about more than one place, but Corinth specifically was like, but before this, before Jesus even, was a military colony, right, that mm-hmm. was established to keep order in the region and to kind of keep the veins of Macedonia or wherever open to the Roman Empire. And to do that, though, to become a military colony, like the city that was there beforehand was like laid to waste, was obliterated from the planet, right? So it's like these colonial histories are, I think, real and active and like should definitely remind us of the world that we live in today more than anything. But they are brutal and definitely like something that would bind a group of people together probably an unsurprising way that people that are there and displaced there would be pretty mad. I get it.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on, a lot more we can say about Paul, a lot more that Horsley says as well. Maybe one last note that we can mention here is on the ways that Paul, on the one hand, is like really embodying this kind of new revolutionary mode of being together, but also on the other hand, is at the same time kind of allowing and permitting other forms of domination to subsist, I guess, not because they're ideal necessarily or even endorsed, but because Paul also has this pretty fervent hope or assumption that the countercultural movement against Rome is just going to win and defeat Rome. So, you know, you should just sort of like wait it out. Not that you shouldn't do anything or withdraw, but that there's like some other things going on there. And that comes in to play mostly with slavery. And this is also a really interesting kind of theme for us on the show. Whenever I think of Paul and slavery, there's a lot of people to think about. a lot of good liberation theologians, black liberation theologians and so on who've written on this. But I always think about Amoria Armstrong's stuff. Amoria did the music for the podcast that you hear every week. But also we had Amoria on a long time ago to talk about a great article that they wrote about Paul and slavery and kind of metaphors around Hagar and freedom and Sarah and so on. It's a really great essay that people should read. But all that to say, Paul, you know, like, I think it's great that Horsley's trying to draw this continuity between Jesus and Paul and make Paul into a really interesting character again and kind of save him for some progressive causes, but you can't get around some of these other issues, and he's deserved some criticism for sure that he's gotten, especially from Black scholars and so on. So, Matt, how does Horsley maybe parse out the slavery piece here and some wider issues going on in Paul?
Yeah, I gotta say, it's interesting, but, like, unsatisfactory, I would say. Mm-hmm. So Horsley says, slavery was central to the political economy of the Roman Empire, in which Paul and his co-workers conducted their mission. The Pauline letters later became part of Holy Scripture that carried divine authority for subsequent Western Christian history, including the history of slavery in European and American history. Horsley's like, you know, obviously, Paul's implicated. We should probably figure that out. But then he goes on to say that once it's recognized that Paul and his co-workers were anticipating the termination of the Roman imperial order, the previous debates about whether Paul opposed or supported slavery seem beside the point. I don't think so, but okay. In the final fulfillment of the kingdom of God, slavery would be terminated along with less extreme forms of domination and exploitation. That slave relations were pervasive in Roman imperial society, however, was one of the key factors in the background to the intense expectation of freedom in Paul's letters. In the Christ events, people had been delivered from slavery and brought into the freedom of the children of God. The question is whether and in what way anticipation of the end of slavery may have affected slave relations in the communities of the alternative society Paul and his co-workers were catalyzing, which were still living in Roman imperial rule, in which slavery was central and slaves were under the coercive domination of their masters. I promise I'm almost done reading. But, well, I'll just stop right there. There's, like, some more kind of contextualization about slaveholding and, like, the curiarchal family and runaway slaves and lots of stuff there. But Horsley says, you know, still in Galatians, Paul cites the baptismal formula that in God, you know, there's neither Jew nor Greek, nor slave nor free, etc. So I guess all that to say, I think that the way that you characterized it earlier, Dean, is probably good. That Paul is, like, you know, trying to say trying to do something different while they're living kind of, like, in opposition to a society that, like, functions on the labor of slaves. But I don't know, waiting around for it to be over is probably not, is not the abolitionist dream. It's not what you want. that's Paul's take, I guess. You know, within these communities, you get the sense that there is a type of egalitarianism, hence the sort of Galatians bit that we all know and love. But, you know, whether or not that's good enough is another question. I mean, the answer is it's not good enough, right? Because because these ideas go on to found, chattel slavery in North America. It goes on to found all, you know, the lasting remnants of white supremacy. It's just like, should have been different. If I was writing it, I wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, exactly. I think Horsley does a good job making the strongest case that I think you can possibly make for, like, going a little easier on Paul or seeing some more interesting things in Paul or whatever, but I agree. It's not ultimately convincing, and at the very least, like, history has not found the cool progressive parts of Paul to be the most, activating parts, and he's been pretty quickly absorbed into oppressive regimes. So anyway, it's definitely worth reading, but so are all these other people, Murray Armstrong and Dolores Williams and lots of other folks. All that to say, let's wrap up this bit on Paul and then talk about how Horsley's connecting the dots to our own time. I think, at least for me, what's really valuable about the Paul stuff is seeing Paul as a community organizer in general. Horsley goes out of his way to mention that Christians see Paul as, like, a heroic individual, and they read an individualistic sort of story into Paul. I think just by virtue of, like, you know, Paul is attributed at least as the author of the majority of the New Testament, at least besides the Gospels. And that means that he has this sort of privileged place in the way that we understand Christianity. And of course, he's also a main character in Acts and is undeniably a pretty, like, larger-than-life guy. But Horsley says, Paul, his whole life makes no sense apart from his participation in this network of communities and his desire to strengthen that community life and kind of be involved in it. And I think that is really cool. So kind of giving the economic piece and then situating Paul into a bigger movement story is really valuable. I don't know, Matt, what do you think? Who's Paul for you now after reading Richard Horsley?
Yeah, you know, I kind of come away feeling like, well, it's interesting that Paul is framed more as a community organizer. That's a cool perspective on Paul that I hadn't considered and makes me kind of more interested. But I feel like I'm still more interested in like the communities that he's writing to. That's so fascinating to kind of think about how these sort of like countercultural movements or like diaspora communities form and are bound together by Christianity. It offers them a framework that they can like actually oppose the Roman Empire by. And I think that's just really fascinating. So as far as Paul is supporting that, then I guess he's great. Except for the other stuff that's not great.
A good take.
I don't like that.
So Horsley, having looked at the political economy of Jesus and Paul, also does go out of his way to write about what might be the contemporary implications of all this. And the way he does it is really interesting. There are a few chapters on the Bible and on both the Old and New Testament that he writes that are pretty good. We're not going to talk about those, but they're worth it. One of them, for example, one chapter is called The Bible and the New Form of Empire, which is great. Like, he talks about sort of decolonial, postcolonial readings of the Bible and trying to sort out, too, how the Bible is implicated in oppressive structures and regimes. And it's like, you know, a pretty good introduction maybe to some of those conversations. So if you're really interested in, I don't know, how scholars are talking about the Bible in a decolonial way, it's not a bad place to go for a bit of an overview. But I think what's especially interesting is the later stuff where he talks about forming alternative communities in but not of the new form of empire. And Matt and I were talking a lot about this throughout the week as we were both reading it. And I was definitely a little suspicious, I have to say, at the very beginning, because I sort of felt like Horsley was going in a bit of a, like, Network of Mutual Aid, Occupy Wall Street direction. But it's actually a way more nuanced take, which, by the way, Network of Mutual Aid and Occupy Wall Street is not the worst direction that you could go, just not the one that I wanted to go, that's all. So just a, a quick asterisk there to that comment, I guess, a footnote in the middle of this podcast. I think that he has a more nuanced take, and Matt was not completely convinced when I was telling him that, so maybe I'll try to convince you of that. Matt, what do you think about that?
Yeah, please do. Win me over.
Okay, great. So on the one hand, because of Horsley's reading of Paul, there is this really strong emphasis in what's really instructive about the early Christian example is that people do come together in this kind of model of mutual aid. They're sharing things with each other, and that starts to create these pockets of resistance to the Roman Empire. And I think the concern is then, like many post-liberal theologians do or other progressive theologians, you sort of draw this one-to-one analogy to say, okay, then that's what we should do now. Just form these kind of like church, you know, church groups. It's like the politics of the potluck, right? You get together and you share your food, you like make meals together, you sing songs that are different than what is sung on the radio, and you kind of like hope for the best. Like, that's your anti-imperial witness. And I was a little nervous that maybe Horsley would go that way too, but he does something cooler. So on Occupy Wall Street, he starts saying this. First, he says, like, during Occupy, if you were going to draw some direct analogies between the biblical story and Acts and so on and the Occupy Wall Street movement, you would, you know, like, probably write a pretty interesting sermon. It would be compelling and cool, but you would also be wrong. And I think this is great because a lot of theologians do say that. He says, the community of Galileans expanded by diaspora Judeans in the provincial capital of Jerusalem was much less sensational than Occupy Wall Street at the very center of the new empire of global capitalism, but much more far-reaching and ambitious in its project than the prolonged but unsustainable protest at Wall Street and other centers of capital. While Occupy became a crystallizing moment for already widespread opposition to global capitalism, the Jerusalem commune was a key step in what began as a local movement among one people subjected to the empire that then expanded steadily outwards among other subject peoples. And the key here, I think, links back to what I was saying earlier about the emphasis on an inter-people assembly in Paul. That one interesting thing about how Horsley reads the text here is that it's not only about class or inequality, but it's about a deeper colonial history. And this is kind of the subtext of his criticism of Occupy, that Occupy is great. Like, he's like, they did a good job, they raised a bunch of awareness, and that's cool, but ultimately, you know, it fizzled out. And what's different about the kind of Christian organizing in the New Testament is that it's not only a protest movement, or it's not only calling attention to inequality, but it's binding together these people who have been colonized in a bigger kind of story about what it means to sort of do life differently. And there is definitely some like prefigurative politics there for sure, no doubt about that. But Horsley goes on to tie it to some more sophisticated analysis of the market and the state. So I'm going to pause there, Matt. What do you think so far?
I think that's fine. I just find like the what you're saying is fine. What Horsley's saying is fine. I agree. But the mapping on the Occupy Wall Street seems like such a weird move because of the vastly different positionalities of these movements. Like, one is from the margins completely, and one is like in the center stage. I don't know. Occupy Wall Street is such like a such a first world sort of like protest movement that it makes me kind of cringe, but that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're on the same page as Horsley. That's what I'm gonna try to convince you.
Okay.
Of. Fair. I think he thinks the same.
I think he does too. I just don't like that he like just don't even bring Occupy Wall Street up. It's a sore subject for me for whatever reason right now.
Yeah, I think that is completely fair, and I'm here for that. But to Horsley's credit, there is sort of like a subgenre of progressive theology that is like way into Occupy, and I think he's trying to sort of speak to that audience a bit. He says, for example, while the movement of renewal of Israel expanding from its base in the Jerusalem commune does not provide a good analogy for Occupy, which raised critical awareness and so on, it offers a model of effective resistance to centralized imperial political economic domination. Building on deep Israelite tradition of communal responsibility for economic aid to the needy, it devised a sharing of resources to enable a movement of resistance to expand in the interstices of imperial control. And he goes on to kind of talk about how one of the big keys is that community was able, or that network of communities could support organizers, or he says new alternative communities, as a support for the base community in which the members had left their own economic base. In the far more complex situation under the power of global capitalism, sharing of resources would probably be more partial, which I think is actually really interesting. There's kind of a criticism of like the anarchist mode of interpreting the Bible, where you're like, well, we should just do that, like make an Acts 2 kind of group, you know, send some money to a few organizers and so on, which, by the way, not a bad thing. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but there's maybe something more sophisticated here in Horsley to say like, if we were really going to do that, like, we would have to take a lot more into consideration. The economic situation is not the same. The way that we even support social movements is not the same, et cetera. So there's some nuance there for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the recognition that this works in the Gospels, or this works in, you know, the New Testament in general, because it's a subsistence economy, right? And like, that's kind of what makes it make sense. But it's, you know, we don't live in a subsistence economy, so we need pretty vastly different ideas. But, you know, these things can still kind of like activate particular networks or give us some nice motivations for doing things. Like, I think that's all pretty fair.
Great. We're so close. all right, two final pieces and we'll wrap it up. So he also has a lot of interesting things to say about the state and the market that I think are really good. Maybe we're out of time to talk about them, but you can read it yourself. I guess the thing I like about it is he says Hart and Negri, they're interesting. They have this cool analysis of empire. There are a lot of Christians who are also really critical of the state, but he says we really need to understand like the complex interrelations between the state and the market and see the state as like an interrelated agent of power along with the market. So anyway, that's great. A more anti-imperialist take than many theologians, my experience. But maybe the key piece here is, I think, where he draws the most direct sort of analogy to the Bible. He talks about withdrawal, or like a politics of withdrawal, and which is a popular move for progressive Christians, right? Like, the world is bad, so you should withdraw into a more kind of insular community. This is like the Howard Wass take. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't say withdrawal, but I think that's what it is. So Horsley says this: while global capitalism has become much more pervasively powerful than any historical empire, it is not yet all-powerful. There is hope for possible partial alternative forms and lines building resistance. It's essential that the criticism that informs resistance be both comprehensive and probing, and not mistake the institutional form of power and its effects. He goes on to say a bunch of other stuff, and then he says, while the United States government has recently exhibited pretenses of exercising imperial power, it was steadily being manipulated by global capitalism through coalitions of transnational corporations. Moreover, what needs to be resisted may be not just the scope of the new empire's power, but the forms in which it is exercised, such as through communications media, the channeling of desire, and the commodified culture of non-meaning. All this cannot be done by individual escape, but might still be done by the collective action of covenanted communities as modeled in the gospel stories. And I think that is pretty interesting, right? Like, Horsley is trying to say, okay, there's something useful in doing historical criticism of the Bible for progressive social movements. And one of those useful things is this kind of model of, like, having communities that are bound together through care and through mutual aid, who then also think about what are the kind of anti-imperial links here, or how does anti-imperialism form like an essential piece of that binding together, not an accidental piece. I think that is pretty good. I'm convinced at least that that's like a great way to use the Bible.
Yeah, fair. I think that is good. A great call to all these mainline denominations sitting on millions of dollars of money to like maybe put it up and do something with it. That's not like, I don't know, redecorate your sanctuary.
That's right. Great. So we've done it. Richard Horsley, The Political Economic Projects of Jesus and Paul, in the book You Shall Not Bow Down and Serve Them. Any big final takes, Matt, final conclusions? What should we do about these great political programs?
I'm here to take them and to be annoying in Bible studies. That's what I'm here to do. And I feel like I've got so much good ammo for that. People are not going to want to invite me back, but sucks for them. Church is not invite only.
I think it's a good note to end on. You can take these great biblical examples, do still organize a potluck at your church, but then use it to talk about new people's democracy.
Thanks for listening to the Magnificast. If you like what you heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/themagnificast. If you do that, you can get a cool invite to our great Discord, where we're always having big convos about hermeneutics and organizing and podcasts and all kinds of other things. So get on in there. Today, someone decided they were going to try to organize a very niche role-playing game, and I think that's great. So you could be part of that if you wanted to. Our intro music is by Mario Armstrong, and our outro music is by The Logical Spoon, and we'll see you next time.
Get up for church in the morning, church in the morning, souls alive. Heaven come to earth and there won't be no church. We'll meet down by the riverside. There we'll swim with all creation. Never get tired, never bored. Don't worry, someday there'll be no dam between us and our Lord. Jackson, keep your hoods up. Keep your hoods up and you stay up late in Jackson. You keep your